Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, and Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2002. It goes out every Friday afternoon at 2 p.m. on BCFM 93.2. This week, two Spanish journalism graduates, Cristina Dorador and José Sendra. They will be explaining what life is like in Spain at the moment and doing a bit of a journalistic report on the country. Also, a former policeman who has decided that drugs should be decriminalised. Plus, our weekly news with Jason Yannakopoulos. But first, it's Spain we go to, with Cristina Dorador and José Sendra. Hi, and welcome to Dialect.
Hello, hi. Tony.
First of all, why have you come to Britain?
To Bristol.
To the UK. Why?
Why? I think that I wanted to improve my English, firstly, and the situation in Spain is not really good, and I decided to come here to improve my English and to look for an opportunity.
Well, your English is already pretty good. What about you? What's your main reason to be here, José?
Yeah, well, I just came here for working because in Spain it was being really difficult to get a proper job.
For a lot of young people, this is the same,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes.
What's life actually like for young people in Spain?
It's really difficult because we are graduates, we are trained people, and in Spain, it's really difficult to find a job. The government spent a lot of money in training us, in give us an education, and now it's really difficult to find a job, and they have not been able to create an opportunity for us.
Yes, they are not trusting young people, and there are no opportunities for the young people.
Well, I mean, is it maybe just that you haven't tried hard enough?
No.
Trust us, we do.
Yeah. Well, there seems to be something. I mean, you know, it's great that you've studied journalism because then at least you've got hopefully some ability to look at the problem of unemployment in Spain and analyse it. Have you done that? Make decisions about why Spain is in this situation?
That's difficult to know why.
What about you, José?
Why? I think the government didn't spend the money in good things in the past.
In wise ways. They haven't been very wise with the way they've spent the money.
Yes, they are thinking in silly things, and they are not thinking in people from the country. They are just arguing all the time, and they are not thinking. And yes, they just spend the money in silly things in the past.
So, how does this affect young people actually over in Spain? Obviously, it's annoying, but I mean, if there aren't the jobs, you're applying and applying. Maybe you've got hundreds of people going for one job. I mean, we're starting to get that here in Britain too. What's it actually like from young people day to day? Because you haven't got money to go out and enjoy yourself, for example.
Yes, well, there were some jobs, like for example, as a sales assistant or that kind of things, or as a waiter in Spain. So you can have that job in Spain, but not a proper job as a graduate, you know?
Like right.
Because you work hard at the university to get a proper job and to work in what you like. And it's really disappointing because now you realize that you have been studying and working hard for the last 5 years at the university or 3 years or whatever. And you realize that you will never get a job.
Yes. Because I was working as a private teacher, so you can always work as a private teacher and you can earn some money, but not having a proper job. And the thing is that the families are helping the young people for living in a proper way, because if not, it would be
impossible.
I mean, what are the social security like in Spain? If you don't have a job, does the government give you some money each week to live on?
No.
Just if you've worked like 6 months. So if it stops at some point. So it's not like every week.
Okay. I mean, it's a bit like Britain, but it sounds like it's worse in Spain, really. Who do you blame? I'm going to ask you, each of you, who do you blame more? Do you blame the banks or do you blame the government, José?
Well, I blame the government because yes, the government is like the representation of the citizens, and they could stop what banks were doing, so I blame the government.
Okay, what about you, Christina?
I am starting to think that they are both the same thing. We've got the government and the banks.
Well, that's funny because here, a lot of people are saying here in England that the city of London, actually owns the government, you know? That they've bought the political party, they buy influence, they use their money to buy influence. Okay, the weather in Spain is generally lovely, yeah? So you would think that maybe people from Britain would be going to Spain. A lot of people from Britain are actually living in Spain now. Have you noticed people deciding when they retire, for example, to go over to Spain?
Yeah. Yes. Especially in some parts of Spain.
Near the beach.
Near the beach and in Mallorca and the islands, there are lots of English people, retired English people.
And German.
And how do they get on with the Spanish population? Do the Spanish people like having them there because they're spending money, or do they find it's a bit annoying to have these people coming in and buying the nice property?
No, English people are really welcome to Spain.
Yes, because they are like spending money.
Okay.
I think they are lovely. Lovely in general.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, what? How much luck have you had over here getting some work? I'll ask you first, Christina.
At the moment, I'm working as a sales assistant in a shop.
But that's just the same as you would be in Spain.
Yes, but here I am learning English.
Ah, I see.
If I would work as sales assistant, I would feel as if I were losing my time because I am not learning nothing.
Yeah.
But here almost I am learning English.
Yeah, so it's not that you just want a job, it's that you want a job that's going to take you somewhere. What about you, Jose? Would you say the same? How are you getting on?
I feel lucky because I'm working as an assistant teacher.
So in different schools.
In different schools because I'm working for two teaching agencies.
Okay.
But I'm working really, really hard because I'm working for two teaching agencies. I have to call every morning for asking in which school I have to go. But yeah, I'm practicing my English, and that's a really good point. So it's not the same. But in Spain, there's no work. We don't have assistant teachers there, and there's no work as a teacher, I can tell you.
I know it's rude to ask a lady her age, Christina.
I'm 24.
You're 24, Jose?
29.
Okay, and how do you think that this is really helping you with your prospects, having come to Britain?
Yeah.
You're adding to your skills, you think?
Yeah.
Why is it that people want to learn English, Christina? You seem really keen on it. Yeah.
Because...
I mean, you don't get many people in England, say, wanting to learn Spanish particularly. I mean, yes, maybe, if you're going to visit or whatever, but is it because there's money in learning English, or is it because you like the
English
language?
With English, you can go everywhere.
Yes. At the very beginning, I started learning English for travelling, but now in Spain, for example, it's becoming really fashionable.
Yes,
like teaching, for example, teaching biology in English and that kind of thing.
Like wearing a nice hat.
Yeah. Right.
I must say, both of your English is fantastic, and you know, I really hope that you get some work in journalism. Let me ask you both, because it's a great. I love journalism myself. You know, I do quite a bit of it, and I like to know what is your real interest. What's your passion that you like to write about, Christina?
I like to write about fashion. I like to write about internet, for example. I have a blog, and I
tell us the address of your blog so listeners can have a look.
I write in my blog.
It's in English, I hope.
Yeah, okay. I started my blog because I wanted to improve my English and to practice my English and to think in English for a while in my room. And I write about lots of things, about, for example, about fashion or about how to shop online or things that I think that I know a lot about, and I want to share my knowledge.
Yeah, great. Well, that's exactly what journalism should be about, just sharing. Not that, you know, you do a little learning journey as a journalist, and then you want to share that with others. Well, what about you, Jose? What's your specialist subject,
I worked in a newspaper during two summers, so I was first in the city.
Where?
Section.
Which city?
Valencia.
In Valencia?
Valencia.
Okay.
So I was born in Valencia, so... Yeah, I had a lot of information in Valencia. And the next summer, I was in the culture section. And
Culture, okay.
Yeah. And yeah, I really like culture, shops, new museums, that kind of things. And I love cinema as well. And just cultural activities in general.
Okay, look, you can't just say, I like cinema. What type of films do you like? Maybe which nationality or what genre of films?
Yeah, well,
give us some good tips, good films to see.
Okay, well, my favorite film, I would say that it's Almost Famous, which is an American film. And I can't remember the director now, but and I really like a Mexican film, which is called Y Tu Mamá También, and Your Mamas and Your Mothers Too, which was nominated to the Oscars.
Okay, why do you like those two films? Tell us a little bit about each one.
They are really different. Well, Almost Famous, it's about a young journalist as well, and yes, he's traveling with a group of musicians around the United States, I think it during the summer, and I really like it because it's, well, he's quite young, but he became an adult during this travel, and I think he's working for the Rolling Stones magazine.
Oh, okay, for a magazine. Yes. And what about the other film?
Yes, and the other film is about two Mexican friends. It's during the summer as well, so they are just thinking about having fun, but they met a young woman, which is a really famous Spanish actress, and at the very beginning they just want to have fun with her, and they started a travel for going to the beach, to the Mexican beach, but they start to meet each other and talk about life, and I like that kind of thing where you can listen conversation about life and
right, so they actually got more close than you might expect. Okay,
yeah.
Christina, your fashion stuff that you like to write about, what is it that inspires you about fashion? Is it women's fashion, men's fashion, children, what kind of fashion gets you going?
I like women's fashion because I am a lady, obviously. But I like to write about everything, and what I like more is to find a way to dress really with a fashion way with an affordable prices.
Ah, right. Yeah. So not to spend a fortune. Well, that's not necessarily easy, is it? So where would you? I mean, you're talking about maybe making your own clothes, or what kind of tips would you have for listeners about how to look good without having to spend lots of money?
I really recommend people to buy online, because you really can't find really good treasures and stuff on internet, for example on eBay or in shops online, and I think that it's shopping online, it's really good to find people that do their own clothes then sell, and that's way to
the trouble. The trouble is, though, you see, you've got sorry to interrupt you, but the trouble is, you never know quite what it's going to look like till it comes through the post, and then maybe you have to send it back.
But you can sell it again.
Okay, trading in fashion. Okay, you didn't say quite legal, that's what you're doing. Anyway, just remind us of your blog again.
Sorry?
Your blog.
My blog.
Where can people find it? Where can we find you?
It's Dora Delos.
You better spell that.
D-O-R-A-D-E-L-O-S.
D-O-R-A-D-E-L-O-S.
Yeah.
And if you just put that
you
into
can
your...
You Google it.
No, no, no. You put it into your favourite search engine, not necessarily Google, because they don't pay as much tax as they're supposed to pay, so maybe it's best to use a different search engine to Google. And facts in America, they've been having a lot of trouble this week too. Apple have now. What, you know, this is getting back really to talk about the financial situation, because a lot of these big companies aren't paying enough tax, are they? I mean, isn't that one of the reasons why we're here?
Yes, I think so. Everything is important in the financial situation. And that kind of things are really, really important.
I mean, if you look at the amount of debt that we are actually increasing at a crazy rate at the moment, it doesn't look like they're ever going to pay it off. So where is this going to end? I'm going to ask you both this question. I ask it of every economist I see. What's going to happen? Because it looks like the debt is increasing so fast, we're never going to pay that debt off. So I'll ask you first, Jose. What do you think is going to happen in, say, 3 or 4 years' time, when the debt is just still going up and it looks like we're never going to pay it off?
Yeah, but I think it's different that that's a problem for the government. Well, it is affecting their citizens.
Well, it's affecting us all, isn't it? I mean, right across Europe. So what's going to happen in 2 years, 3 years' time?
Well, I think we are going to be all right because people, we'll find a way.
Well, I mean,
all right, but I don't know how.
Okay, Christina, what's your thoughts? 2 or 3 years' time, if we still haven't paid the debt, it's still going up. I mean, there's going to be even less work around. What's going to happen?
I don't know. Honestly, I don't know.
Well, I'll tell you one little thing.
I think that we will find a way to survive to that.
We will as well. And there's one country that's done very well is Iceland. I don't know if you've been watching them up in the North Sea, looking down on Europe, saying, well, look, guys, we've sorted it out. We found a few bankers, a few politicians, put them in jail, and we started again. And everything's fine. In fact, it's very easy. In fact, you want to get a job, you might want to go to Iceland once you've learnt your English. In fact, I shouldn't say that because both of you speak incredibly good English. Anyway, maybe we'll speak to you in future weeks with reports if you're able to pop into dialect. Mm-hmm. But Spanish journalism graduates Cristina Dorador and Jose Sendra, thanks very much for joining us on dialect.
Thank you,
Tony.
BCFM 93.2, the Bristol station you can count on.
Right now I'm joined by Philip McGowan and Rita Candelucci. You better pronounce it for me. It's one of those...
Candelucci.
What is it? Italian, Spanish, Southern European of some sort?
Italian.
Lovely. Right, and we'll start with you then, Rita. You're based at the Ark Bar in Broad Street.
Yeah.
You're planning something to do with Palestine. What are you up to?
Yeah, on the 14th of June, there will be a benefit gig for Palestine.
Okay, what day of the week is that?
It's Friday, and there will be an evening. And through the night, and the day after, we organize. We're gonna open a Palestine embassy.
So, have you got the permission from the Palestine Authority to do that?
Yes, we do.
So, what is the real purpose of the embassy? Is it a bit of public relations for the Palestinian people?
Yes, a little bit of everything.
Anything practical?
Practical as well, cultural, and there will be food, Palestinian food. And we can show Palestinian films, like 5 broken cameras, another film during the day. And main purpose is creating a Palestinian agency in Bristol.
Okay, well, why is it then that you're interested in the Palestinian cause?
I'm a member of Palestinian Solidarity Campaign, which is a big group in Bristol. And we feel like we have to create, after the United Nations recognition, we have to create an agency for the Palestinians.
So what's happened is the UN have recognised Palestine, have they?
Yeah.
Or are they about to? They have done, or what?
They've done it.
Okay, they've done that. And so now they're recognised as a country. You're going to be an embassy. What, you're going to have a Palestinian flag on the door?
Yes. A big one.
And lots of nice Palestinian food inside.
Yes.
Okay, so just remind us when this is happening.
On the 15th. The day after the 14th of June will be the benefit gig. And the 15th, there will be all day long big celebration.
Okay, lovely. I'm also joined by Philip McGowan. You're organising something which is not Palestine, but South Africa related, Philip.
Nelson Mandela is going to be 95 in July. And every year I've been organising a big birthday celebration here in the UK. This year it's going to be at the Ark, and it's going to be a big event on Saturday. During the day we're going to have photo exhibition, we're going to have film screenings, and then in the evening we've got more musicians than we have volunteered, than we might not be able to put them all on. It's going to be such a night. We've got some Sierra Leonean musicians want to come down from London. We've got a singer-songwriter coming from Scotland. We're going to have community singing the South African National Anthem, which means Nkosi Sikelele. And we're going to be celebrating Mandela's life. If, unfortunately, he dies before then, we're still going to go ahead as a celebration of his life. And we intend to carry on every year doing a birthday celebration.
Fantastic. What about you? What, have you any connections with South Africa?
Yes. I was a member of the ANC for many years. I lived in Botswana.
Okay. And what was it? I mean, Botswana, where's that compared to South Africa?
It's right next door, the Kalahari, in the middle of Africa.
Tell us what it was like living over there, because, I mean, under an apartheid regime, and what was it that got your interest in joining the ANC? I mean, it was generally a black organisation, wasn't it? And you're a white man.
there was something called the Congress of Democrats, which was mainly white people who were supporting the ANC from the 1950s. Good friends of mine, Jewish friends of mine, were members of the Congress of Democrats and supported the ANC from the 1960s. So it's never been a clear black versus white issue.
Now, Nelson Mandela was a terrorist. Why are you celebrating his birthday? Of a terrorist.
The state he was against was far more terroristic than anything that the ANC, any violence or that the ANC, they had massive prisons, huge repression of the population. That is terrorism in my view. A few armed actions against the police and the army don't compare to the violence that was perpetrated against the black population.
And even the UN say you've got a right to self-defence, don't they? Don't they? I mean, the United Nations Charter says that everyone... Actually, maybe this is just states have a right to self-defence. I'm not sure if communities who are being repressed by states have a right to self-defence.
Yes, it was a form of self-defence. They felt under attack. Their population was under attack with huge army and police networks, spies, killer squads sanctioned by the state, huge prisons where people were incarcerated for years at a time. Yes, we do have a right to self-defence.
OK, and just remind us of when your events are happening.
Saturday, July the 20th. In the afternoon will be the festival, in the evening will be the concert.
And the Palestine event, Rita?
And on the 14th of June and the 15th of June.
Lovely. Thanks very much for both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now I'm joined by Jason Yannakopoulos. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Danny.
Clutching your copy of Private Eye again, and you're
this
smiling.
It is absolutely amazing stuff here, everyone.
It says this is the edition with a coalition in crisis on the front.
It's got David Cameron and Nick Clegg, and David Cameron saying, "I can't work with the Tories anymore."
and the actual the title of this is "Where There's Muck, There's Brass Plates." Okay, so
this is a story of how ghost companies in the UK have made Britain, that's this country, the capital of global corporate crime, and it's talking about the setting up of things called limited liability partnerships.
LLPs.
LLPs. Now, these are interesting because before that we had PLC, public listed companies, which are owned by, well, stakeholders and...
Shareholders.
Well, shareholders and... Shareholders and the taxpayer. And in some ways...
I mean, it's not a limited company. Limited company is different to a limited liability partnership.
Well, yes, that's the other one. You had limited companies before that. And the difference between a limited company and limited liability partners, limited companies are ones that are owned by a certain person, their stakeholders. And so the difference is that limited liability partnerships act as if they are limited companies, except that they don't have to pay the excess tax or have a natural real-life coordinator, as it were, that limited partnerships have. So these limited liability partnerships are set up in places like Mayfair in the UK. We've got one here set up in Birmingham, and they can claim to be dormant and all that. They can claim to be a company, and yet they're paying out ridiculous amounts of money to companies like in Cyprus or something like that, or in Belize, and they can be registered as being owned by somebody in Granada, who in turn are owned by sort of empty companies in the UK. Basically,
hang on, what's an empty company?
These are companies which have been set up to be registered as the owners of other companies, the companies themselves don't actually exist.
Sort of a shell company.
They are shell companies. That's what they are.
Oh, my goodness. You know what this is starting to sound like to me? It sounds a bit like money laundering.
In fact, I think that's kind of what it is.
Moving money around to disguise where it's actually being coming from and also to try and avoid tax. Now, I suppose the long and short of it, Jason, is this legal?
Strictly speaking, I'm really bad at this, may sound strictly speaking no, but there's nothing that you can do about it because a lot of these companies are UK registered but have no UK business, and therefore it's not taxable even if they are registered in the UK and they have an office in the UK.
But money is still going out and in from these companies even though they're dormant. I mean, that's surely that's not possible.
You would have thought, but for some third reason, tax authorities seem to be ignoring this. I mean, the fact that UK registers means that not only because our tax men aren't really interested in it because they're not making any UK business, but also foreign tax collectors are also not interested in it because they're registered to the UK.
Okay, because it's based here. Oh,
yeah.
You know, the other thing is, of course, that these tax havens, we had the possibility anyway at this G8 conference that's going on. You know, quite what use this conference is at all, I really don't know. But one of the things they're supposed to be talking about, Jason, is getting rid of the British tax havens. And the funny thing is that almost all of these companies, they are based in British territories. You know, they're kind of autonomous, the British protectorates and things, places like the Cayman Islands, the British Virgin Islands, Jersey, the Channel Islands. And it's one of the biggest places. We are probably the biggest country in the world that keeps these tax havens going. So do you think there's any chance at the G8 that David Cameron is going to actually close down the tax havens? And actually, it's partly the job of the Queen, because she is the monarch of these tax havens too.
Well, I mean, just take a look at any point in history over the past hundreds of years, because liability partnerships is not something new. In fact, this is something that's been going on, according to Private Eye, since Victorian times, to the point where Gilbert and Sullivan even created a show based, they created a satirical opera based on this.
Who did?
Gilbert and Sullivan.
Gilbert and Sullivan. What was that called? Do you know?
It's called Utopia Limited.
Fantastic. Okay, so that's exactly what it is, isn't it? It's a company where you don't have to pay your tax. The funny thing is, of course, that the people who are having to pay their tax are, you know, people who are paying VAT, and anything you buy basically has got tax on it, almost, apart from books and baby clothes and things like that. So everyone else, is whilst they're buying things, is paying tax, but these people aren't.
Well, it's got three companies it mentions here as being particularly intriguing. There's one that was they visited Kiev, and Ukraine were interested because also the arms manufacturing heartland as Ukraine was, there were a list of British shell companies taking weapons away from the Ukraine and supplying countries such as Sri Lanka, Syria, Libya and Rwanda.
Oh, no.
In breach of international sanctions.
Oh no. Oh gosh.
And the companies went under names like Espas Soft Trading Limited, which was owned, which was from Cyprus, and this company was from Cyprus and was owned by some dormant companies in the Bahamas, and they were literally doing that. And surprising enough, this was also owned, this company in turn was owned by some companies based in the UK.
God, so it seems as if whenever there's anything a bit difficult or dodgy that might make a profit, that profit is moved offshore. Or into a company which is, or possibly through a dormant company. Look, but answer the question, Jason. I'm a terrible stickler for getting you to answer the question.
Go on.
Do you think David Cameron is going to do anything about, or the Queen is going to do anything about British tax havens?
Well, of course not. Where do you think David Cameron's going to go once he's finished being a politician? What do you think he's going to get involved in? He's going to get involved in exactly this.
Yeah, well, also his father, wasn't he? He started off the whole business after Margaret Thatcher dropped exchange controls. David Cameron's dad was one of the first people to set up whole businesses based around moving people's money offshore so they didn't have to pay tax here in the UK. So I'm surprised. Be surprised if David Cameron is the man to do it. But anyway, come on, Dave. We think you should.
Well, absolutely, yes.
Because someone's going to have to pay off this deficit, and it should really be the people who are supposed to be paying the tax that help pay it off. Okay, what about any other stories in the news generally, Jason?
Well, not so much.
Hang on. We better pause there.
Pause.
Ready.
Well, there's this story about the residence parking here.
Well, yes, we've got a copy of the Bristol Post. It used to be called the Evening Post. On the front page, pensioners in Montpellier hold a peasants' revolt to protest against George Ferguson's parking scheme.
Now, I'd love it if they genuinely was a peasants' revolt in Bristol. That'd be amazing.
In fact, look, they've got forks. They've got what looks like a rather potentially rather nasty scythe weapon. And that chap in the middle there is shaking his fist at George. Now, I thought George was
I have noticed they've got George's red pants as well.
They were yes. up on the fork. So it looks like people are getting rather fed up with this. They're saying that they don't want to pay. It's going to cost £10 million to get this scheme going in the first place. But obviously, once it's in, the council are going to start raking it in. Now, Jason, what are people going to have to actually be paying?
Well, it's people practically paying from their houses out on the road, and it's £48 for one car and £96 for two, and Lord only knows what happens if you've got any more than that.
I think it goes, over £100, doesn't it? Maybe £140 for a third car. But hang on a minute. There is a point to this, surely. At the moment, large parts of the city, Montpellier, St Paul's, one of the worst affected, are just simply car parks, aren't they? People come in. As people drive off in the mornings to work in other parts of the city, so other people come in who are working in the city and park, and so there is a real serious problem with parking in the city. This something's got to be done about it. So if they're not going to do this, Jason, come on, what are they going to do?
Well, we have to find an alternative measure, because it's a little unfair just to lump all this on the people who are actually living in the city.
Effectively, what you could do is you could allow a free parking permit, one per household or something. But then the council would have to administrate that. Then they could pay for it maybe by charging for a second permit, for example. And if people want to be greedy and have lots of cars, well, we could say greedy, but of course, some households have got three or four people that all need vehicles. Maybe if public transport was better, people wouldn't need so many cars.
Well, Jason. Exactly. This has been a problem that Bristol had many years, because I've been around here for nearly 10 years now, and I know we have many issues with transport up towards Ewing in that area. So we need more reliable transport. We need...
Actually, that was one of the buses that did work quite well, wasn't it? The one that goes up and down to Ewing.
Well, the number 70, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean... Yeah, you asked any UE student about what they think of Essex Red, and maybe not broadcast.
So ultimately, it looks like this is going to happen, the residents parking. But the trouble is, of course, if you talk to anybody else in the country who's got these big resident parking schemes, it's what they call a cash cow, isn't it? So as soon as a few years have gone by, even if it's not madly expensive to start with, which this one does seem like it is expensive to start with, they slowly jack the price up.
It becomes gradually more expensive because they have the right to
do that. The other thing is they start saying things like, you're going to have to pay £20 to have visitors. Hang on a minute, what's this all about? And all of a sudden, the council is not actually taking money from the rates like it used to do, like a little bit from everybody's property who's a wealthy property owner of some sort. What it's now doing is it's trying to get the poorer and poorer people to pay, and also to get everybody to pay a bit for this. But ultimately, at least it means that there's going to be some kind of control over parking. I think, one of the most important things is to get people who are actually commuting to Bristol, Jason, I don't know what you think about that, to be paying a bit to park, because at the moment what they're doing is they're just parking in residential streets, walking into town, many of them.
Well, maybe there needs to be some form of some form of car parking control for people who don't actually live in Bristol, commuting into. Doesn't bother me too much. I don't have a car, so I do it by train. So.
Yeah, good. How do you find the train? Our first bus, first group, and the first Great Western.
That's quite reliable.
What about the seats, though? This is the thing that bothers me about them. 4 or 5 years ago, they decided to compress all the carriages, didn't they? And have everyone sitting upright, squashed right up against each other.
Well, it's... That is a bit of an issue. I've kind of got used to it. I still find the time to go to sleep occasionally.
Yeah, at least it's reliable. That's something, even if it is rather expensive. Okay, Jason, just one other story we're going to look at very, very briefly. It's the residents' parking stories in a little bit more detail. And that is that there are 18 resident parking schemes, and it's going to cost £10 million. I think the councillor behind it is Mark Bradshaw. He's got the poison chalice. He's a Labour councillor, so Mayor Ferguson has now got Labour councillors on his cabinet, and it's Mark Bradshaw's job to sort this one out. Oh. I don't envy him the problem.
Good luck, Labour.
I just think the most important thing for me is that they don't turn it into just a money-making scheme, that this is a service that the council run, because the temptation is just to jack up the prices, and that, it seems, is what's going to happen.
Yeah. They've got to be reliable. the council cabinet has to be respectful of the people it represents, as should any MP. Whether or not that happens is another matter entirely.
Okay, Jason, thanks very much for joining us this week.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks.
Bristol Community FM is a registered charity, which means we're not for profit, and we're now able to support local business by offering low-cost promotional announcements and adverts about your business or products. You can even sponsor a show, event or outside broadcast. So why not support the station that supports the communities of Bristol, and contact us today to find out more. BCFM 93.2 FM. Bristol is our community.
And we're having a journey through the solar system, aren't we? Paul Fernie's joining me again. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Tony.
Now, we've been heading out fast, probably nearly light speed.
Absolutely.
From the sun. We've just passed Earth. We've just passed Mars.
We're heading towards Jupiter. However, there is a little... an area of space that's often forgotten in these sort of... journeys, the asteroid belt.
Ah, good idea not to forget it, because an asteroid can be rather nasty if you crash into it at the speed of light.
Yes, it can be, and it can be rather nasty if it crashes into Earth at the speeds they're travelling at. But
okay, so there's been a bit of news, hasn't there, about an asteroid heading for us. Have you seen that?
Yeah, I was actually...
Sorry to jump that one on you.
Yeah, that's all right. I was going to cover that at the end, but...
Is there anything to worry about?
No.
It's the size of a bus? Or
yeah, basically,
bigger.
As far as near-Earth asteroids go, as of May last year, there were 8,880 sort of registered near-Earth asteroids, ranging from 1 metre to 32 kilometres in diameter.
Crikey, okay.
There are currently no high-threat near-Earth asteroids to be concerned about.
How big do they have to be to start to be... I mean, 32 kilometres across, that's not going to really burn up, is it, as it comes in the Earth's atmosphere? It's probably going to hit the ground with quite a clunk.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is that when astronomers look at these near-Earth asteroids, they're looking more at the orbit as opposed to the size of it. You know, it really, when something... of anything of any reasonable size is travelling at those sorts of speed, it's going to cause some damage. You know, it's about damage limitation, this is. You know,
can you do damage limitation? You can't dodge the Earth out of the way.
Well, this is it. I mean, that's sort of the problem, really. So it's sort of identifying the objects that whose orbits are going to bring them closest to us, not so much about size. You know, if something's 950 kilometres wide and it hits us, it's lights out, game over. You know, really, and you're going to see it coming. You know, a lot of these objects are sort of mapped over a period of time. You know, they have to follow them. You know, and what happens is they will identify an object that may be on an orbit that brings it very close to the Earth, or maybe even shows that it may impact the Earth at some point. However, they may have only just identified this object and not known it from Adam previous to that. So they can only model the orbit, but as they follow it over a period of time, so once they've seen it, they can follow it. They start to see the orbital perturbations of it, and they can refine their prediction for where it's going to actually go. I mean,
when you say they, is that NASA?
It's the International Astronomical Union, that all-seeing governing body.
Okay,
that look after things like this, Tony. I mean, Just to highlight, 99942 Apophis broke the record for the highest level on the Terrestrial.
That's an asteroid, is it?
It is an asteroid. It broke the record for the highest level on the Torino scale. The Torino scale is the Earth impact risk. Until August 2006, when the probability for a 2029/2036 impact was lowered. Basically, Apophis, they identified it, and it was going to pass very close to the Earth in 2029. And early predictions showed that
It's a big one, I take it.
It's not excessively large, but it's big enough to cause a bit of damage. And when it passed the Earth in 2029, the prediction showed that it would pass through a gravitational keyhole, which would alter its orbit sufficiently that in 2036, when its orbit brought it back round again, it would impact the Earth.
What's a gravitational keyhole?
A gravitational keyhole is an area of space where the gravity from two bodies is sufficient enough to change the orbital
Oh, right, OK. So it's come so close to Earth, it's changed its trajectory.
Yeah, it's changed its trajectory, basically. However, this was overruled in 2006. Further refinement of its orbital distance periods and all that sort of thing showed that it wasn't actually going to pass through that keyhole.
Phew, OK.
There was another one that was pegged for 2019, but again, they've found that it's not actually going to impact the Earth. They see an object, they have to predict its orbit. As they observe the object, the orbit becomes apparent through obvious
observation. Yeah, it gets more accurate.
And it gets more accurate.
What are these asteroids doing hitting Earth? Because they're supposed to be in between Mars and Jupiter, aren't they? They're supposed to be
basically asteroid belt. It lies roughly between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter, and it consists of many irregular shaped bodies called asteroids or minor planets. It's termed the main asteroid belt or main belt to distinguish its members from asteroids in the solar system, such as near-Earth asteroids and Trojan asteroids. Now, you sort of asked the question there, what they're doing near-Earth is supposed to be in the asteroid belt. The asteroid belt is affected heavily by Jupiter's orbit and Jupiter's gravity. And what happens is there are periods when the orbits of Jupiter and the Sun get into a particular position where the gravitational forces are high. And what happens is this affects the asteroids. The asteroids generally, the largest sort of minor planet asteroid is 950 kilometres, and that's Ceres. Do apologise.
Okay. This is very good. You got all off the top of your head. It's very good.
Yeah. As Jupiter orbits the Sun, it lines up at particular gravitational points which cause perturbations in the asteroid belt, and it creates it kicks them out of the solar system sometimes, and it kicks them into the orbits of the inner planets, so that's Mercury, Venus, Earth and Mars.
Right.
And this is how we pick these things up. Also, some of the stuff that some of the asteroids that come from an area of space called the Oort cloud, which is right on the very outside of the solar system. And these objects, often the Oort cloud's associated with comets, where a lot of the comets come from. And some of the asteroids that are floating around, some of these minor planets, are actually.
So what we're saying really is that the asteroid belt is not the only place where the asteroids are. They're just a little focused there.
It's a little focused.
A couple of questions. One is, what are these things? Are they just kind of lumps of granite? What are they?
They're just lumps of leftover building blocks of the solar system.
Rock?
Rock. Most of it's rock. Most of the material can be sort of aligned with what material makes up the inner solid planets, as I spoke about last week, the terrestrial planets.
Okay, and what about, on our little journey out of the universe in our little spaceship, Paul, are we going to make it through the asteroid belt, or are we going to get whacked?
We will, yeah. It's so thinly distributed numerous craft have traversed it without any incident. It is interesting. It goes back to this whole thing that space is called space because it's full of space. If you see images of the mapped asteroid belt,
there's not a lot out there.
There's not a lot. But if you look at images, if you look at these images where they've mapped it, it looks really dense, but it's not actually. I mean, the asteroid belt's made up of material that's anything with the size of a grain of dust, right up to Ceres, which is 950 kilometres. You can actually view some of these asteroids with binoculars and a telescope.
And what are they like?
They show up. And
how do you distinguish them between an asteroid and a moon? Because when you get a big asteroid, you're starting to get towards a moon size.
Not really. No. I mean, a moon is specifically a moon because it's in orbit with another planet, and it's following.
Do you get asteroids that whiz around each other and gravitational effect on each other?
Yes, you do. And you do get this. I mentioned them earlier. The Trojan asteroids, which are asteroids which are in the same orbital plane as another planet or body, but they don't collide because the Trojans sit at the Lagrangian points, which is where gravitational forces are equally balanced, so it holds.
In a way, that's like for example, if it's going round roughly, say, for example, with the Earth, it's almost like it's a bit of the Earth that is slightly behind us, on the orbit.
Actually any for Earth. Jupiter has Trojans, is known to have its Trojan asteroids that sort of, they're called Trojans because obviously they're sort of seen as a protector, but they don't really. They're more just, Jupiter sort of sweeps a lot of this stuff up as it goes around in its orbit.
Okay, Paul, asteroids, I think we've covered that pretty thoroughly.
Yeah.
On to Jupiter next week.
Indeed, Jupiter, yes. Big one next week.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks very much, Tony.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
US filmmaker Alan Frankovich made the definitive documentary for Channel 4 about the Lockerbie bombing. The film's called The Maltese Double Cross, and it was never repeated, but you can watch it online. It presents compelling evidence of a secret motive for the American CIA to have blown up Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie on the 21st of December 1988. Frankovich also directed a three-part Operation Gladio film for the BBC Time Watch series, which was shown to stunned audiences in 1992. It documented NATO blowing up European civilians and blaming it on the Russians, the Red Brigades, the Baader-Meinhof, and even the IRA. Frankovich died of a suspicious heart attack in Houston Airport Customs Hall in 1997. Along with feature films of Greek-born French filmmaker Costa Gavras, Frankovich's 1970s and 1980s documentaries give us a deep insight into the criminal side of the Western intelligence agencies such as MI6, the CIA, the Israeli Mossad, and NATO intelligence in Brussels. All these secret political operations were deniable, but carried out under the secret orders of prime ministers, presidents, and royalty. Frankovich was interviewed in October 1982 by Alternative View in Austin, Texas, just after he released In Company Business, his film all about the CIA. Frankovich described the CIA as a kind of Rotary Club version of the Nazis' hated secret police, the Gestapo.
The CIA's been on company business for years, so what's been its job in France, Italy, Guatemala, Iran, Cuba, and the Congo? And what does Colby know, and Agee, Jackson, Braden, Nixon, Marchetti, Helms, Bundy, Stockwell, Church? And what about Truman, Ike, Kennedy? The CIA's been on company business in stealth. Now, we find out.
It looks like the CIA, then, is the massive hit squad of the multinational corporate system.
Yeah, I think that's why the film is called On Company Business. You know, it's interesting that the CIA, the people in the CIA refer to themselves as the company. Mm-hmm. And if you look at, strictly, you look at, say, the world situation, the geopolitical situation, the United States has two, and now actually four major rivals. It used to just be the two major communist countries, the Soviet Union and China. The CIA has never had any success at all against those two countries. In the 50s, they were parachuting people into Russia to set up guerrillas, and they all got wiped out at the moment. China, the same thing. They've been extremely successful against Guatemala, against Iran, against Chile, against Angola, against any of a number of countries.
Although some of those backfired, like the Angola.
Well, a lot of them are going to backfire in the end, you see, because it comes down to, you really think in the end that you can control people by beating them down, by getting them mad at you, by making them starve to death and watch their children die at 4 or 5 years old? And in the end, I don't think you can, because in the end, if you're going to watch your children die at 4 or 5 years old, you're going to come out and fight. That's all you have. That's all you have left. And one of the great stories I like to tell is how James Angleton, the head of the CIA's counterintelligence corps, and this is the part of the CIA which is designed to protect the CIA from penetration by Soviet agents. Well, the highest level Soviet penetration we know of into Western intelligence, at least that I know of, is Kim Philby, who was a top British intelligence officer who was working for the Soviet Union for the last 20 or 30 years. He was stationed in Washington to be the liaison between the CIA and the British intelligence service, particularly on Soviet affairs. And Kim Philby at one point was in charge of these parachute drops into the Soviet Union. And of course, these people never survived. When he was in Washington, James Angleton, who loves the British, is a great Anglophile, he went to Yale University and thinks Cambridge and Oxford, he would have lunch with Philby about three times a week, and God knows what they discussed. I'm not saying that Angleton is working for the Soviet Union, but he certainly couldn't see what was right in front of his face, because this man was talking with a British accent, was browbeating him with a British accent, and so on. So here you have this great organization with 10,000 employees, and God knows what their budget is, because that's a secret. Going up and beating up, you know, people in Guatemala, which is no big accomplishment, really, considering the poverty there.
That was US filmmaker Alan Frankovich speaking to the Austin, Texas VHS video news magazine Alternative Views way back in 1982.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
And last weekend in St Paul's, there was the first annual AGM of something called Normal, N-O-R-M-L, which is a campaign about drugs. And speaking at it was the president of LEAP UK, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, and that's a former fraud squad officer in the Metropolitan Police, Rowan Bosworth Davis.
I'm Rowan Bosworth Davis, former Metropolitan Police officer, and I'm now the president of LEAP, which is an international organisation. LEAP stands for Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. So I'm actually the president of the UK chapter, love that word chapter, don't you? Yeah. Of the organisation, and what we're trying to do is to help to engineer and encourage and promote debate on the subject of prohibition of narcotics, but in a way we're hoping to help to get the government to promote this in a much more reasoned, much more moderate way, based on evidence rather than, you know, fantasy and some of the nonsense that gets churned out by the red-top tabloid press.
You talk about evidence. What evidence have you got that prohibition is a bad thing? Because so many parents, they just don't want drugs to be out there on the market for their children to consume.
No, of course they don't, and that's precisely the problem. That debate has been whipped up and has been driven by a very emotive and dishonest campaign that has been generated by those people who are opposed to this whole concept of people having a right to engage with narcotics. But there is another side to this coin, and that is that by maintaining this process of prohibition, we're not actually stopping children ingesting narcotics. No one's going to tell me that because we have these policies of prohibition that it's stopping kids, because we know it isn't stopping them. But what it is doing is creating an environment and helping to develop a market where, if you like, the government has completely washed their hands of the responsibility for controlling this market and put it into the hands of criminals. So you and I are now living in a country where we have an illegal market that is controlled by criminals, yet whole swathes of people refuse to debate the ways and means in which we can wrest that control away from the criminals and put it into the hands of the government.
But aren't you washing your hands of the whole business? Surely, as a former police officer yourself, it was your job to nail these criminals, and you haven't really done that.
Well, it's easy for people to say, I haven't done it. I did the job that I was given, which was in the area of financial crime. But the fact of the matter is that trying to impose the law and trying to affect the law, they just aren't the hours in the day and the police officers available to do that.
Are you saying that the narco traffickers are actually stronger than the police, that they can actually outwit them every turn?
Well, it's not a question of stronger and outwitting them. It's a question of realities. They've got the money. They don't have to acknowledge the rules and the regulations and the courts of law. They don't have to abide by rules of evidence. So to the extent that are they better at doing what they're doing than the police? Oh, yes, of course they are.
That was Rowan Bosworth Davis from LEAP UK, L-E-A-P, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. And he was speaking at a conference in Bristol, put together by Normal UK. That's N-O-R-M-L UK, which is working to reform cannabis laws. Well, that's all for this week. Dialects, a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 2 o'clock every Friday afternoon. If you're online, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Tuesday evening when Dialect goes online. And you can do that or download this weekly podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Dialect is a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, and you'll find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week, so thanks for listening, and until the same time next week, goodbye.
fine young bloods who think yourselves immune from the traps that time will set in the sweetest tune. You must whistle up your wind and rosin up your bow, but none can foretell which is the path the restless muse will go. Oh, this rocky road, it makes the poor heart sore. If I ever get up this rocky road, I'll never get on it anymore. And I drink the tumblers dry just to loosen up my tongue, and I'd sing the weary miles behind with a rambling song. Oh, this rocky road, it makes a poor heart sore. If I ever get off this rocky road, I'll never get on it anymore. Get up this rocky road, and I never get on it anymore. Well, I've roamed around this world, and I've rolled about in the waves. I've met with poor men who were kings, and rich men who were slaves. And I've knelt beneath the spires, and I've heard some holy men bend the words of it, the world as it seems to them. If I ever get up